Hiya, food fans and podcast people. This is Alton Brown, and you're now listening to the Alton Brown Cast. There's probably some fancy music or something playing under my voice, but I actually can't hear it. So you guys should email me or something. Let me know how that's working out. Anyway, today on the show, which is coming to you from a small padded room above my garage in Atlanta, Georgia, we're going to answer some questions from the internet. And of course, we're going to have a fascinating interview. And today is going to be an interview with someone that, quite frankly, unless you're into menswear, and I'm going to admit, I'm kind of a clothes horse. I'm not going to say I'm a dandy because I don't have any like big floppy ties or top hats, and I don't walk around with a cane or anything, and I don't wear spats. I don't even own spats. So I'm not exactly a dandy, but I am something of a clothes horse. And we're going to have a guy on the show his name is Sid Mashburn. And if you're into menswear or you live around Atlanta, you certainly know that this Sid is a haberdasher and designer who has changed the way the guys dress around here. We're going to have him on the show because he's certainly changed. He's had a kind of a big effect on my life, kind of helped me find out who I am with clothes. And that's something that a lot of guys in America just, they don't have that. So we're not going to be on food today, guys. We're going to be on fashion, which also starts with an F. So I figure it's, you know, the next best thing. So that's it. I hope you'll stay tuned. All right, so I know that you folks are used to listening to food people ramble on here on the Alton Brown Cast, but not today. Or I've brought into the studio the gentleman that was responsible for me learning how to spend large amounts of money on men's clothing. And he's throwing up his hands as though he's innocent. We have a Sid Mashburn in with us. Sid Mashburn, if you're a man and you live in Atlanta, you already know who he is. And truth is, through a lot of the South and even beyond that, because, well, when I met you, Sid, and welcome, by the
Thank
way,
you, very much.
You were just, you just had a little men's shop there in, off of Howell Mill Road. And now, people know you everywhere. You make your store makes the top menswear store lists all over the country.
We're pretty fortunate. So we've the thing we walk in every day and say is boy, how do we take care of customers in a way they're not really accustomed to being taken care of?
Well, these days customers aren't used to being taken care of at all.
You're so right. And the sad thing is when you get this way, you start expecting other people to act similarly, and you get kind of frustrated, particularly when it comes to travel. And, you know, you're fortunate in that you get to fly your own or take care of your own travel.
Most of my time,
but
yeah,
for some of us who have to go through Hartsfield.
I still do that. I still have to go to L.A. and other
Hartsfield
places.
Hartsfield is pretty friendly.
Oh, it's
just
incredibly
the actual
friendly
interaction with those dadgum airlines that makes it a little bit frustrating. But overall, what we want to do is really try to take care of people and not just sell them some clothes, but say, hey, we're kind of a concierge for your life. You're traveling to Italy. Let us send you our walking tour of Florence. Or, oh, you're going to London. Let us send you our walking tour of London. Or you need, we had a guy come in recently and say, oh, Sid, I just got a speeding ticket. Do you know a lawyer? And we said, I'll be right back. And so, and then someone called later on that day and said, hey, can you get us reservations to Bacchanalia? And so what we're finding is that besides being a clothing store, we're kind of being a sort of a trusted advisor / concierge for people who just need things. And so many people out there just need a little something extra, whether it's advice or direction.
So are you going to like start selling memberships where I'm going to pay an annual fee to have access to the Sid Mashburn Brain Trust, and that when I need something, I just call you and you guys make it happen?
Well, what's funny is that my wife in the very beginning said, after she saw the store, because the store, when you walk in, it's a little bit, it has a little bit of a club vibe to it.
Oh, it's 100% club vibe.
Yeah. And so she said, you know what? Maybe we shouldn't be selling clothes. Maybe we should just be selling memberships. And so funny enough, you look at like Costco, which I'm probably going to get the details of Costco off, but their primary revenue provider is really the memberships. You know, they take very little markup on their product, and they do a pretty fantastic job. But anyway, the club idea is something, if we can act that way always, it'd be a nice way to be. And the other nice thing to that, Alton, and I know that you feel this way because you appeal to people all the way across the spectrum, which we when we wrote the business plan for our company, we said, you know what, we don't really want a demographic to address. We want kind of the psychographic approach. So whether you're
psychographic, you don't hear that word very often.
And whether you're 15 or whether you're 85, if you're a male, this is your shop.
Yep.
And so these days, everything's so demographicked out, you know, yep. Oh, we're for the 32 to 37 year old and, you know, who makes between, you know, $65,000 and $90,000 a year. And they live in, you know, this zip code. We're trying to run away from that and say, gosh, how do we treat everybody that comes in the door exactly the same way? So it's a little egalitarian, a little populistic, but again, it's the way you respond on your shows.
Yeah.
How do I appeal to everybody?
Well, and you do that partially by just doing what you do.
Yeah.
And including everybody in it, you know. I mean, your shop does have a very club feel because there is a sense of belonging that comes with visiting your shop after you've been a few times. And then there's the trust of getting good advice and being taught something. I don't think there's ever been a time that I've walked in your shop where you or one of your guys didn't teach me something. You know, I didn't know. I mean, I still don't know anything about fabric, but anything that I do know about fabric or jacket construction or anything else was because somebody there took the time to explain it to me.
Right.
And you got guys on sewing machines right there in the room.
Who were pretty good.
Who are awesome at what they do, which really, really helps. Now, this is not a model that's – I don't see this very often. I mean, I go to a lot of menswear shops.
Right.
I got a little bit of a clothing problem. It's only a problem when the credit card doesn't clear. But you don't see this very often. How did you know to do it, and when did you come up with the idea for this? I know you spent time at Land's End, right? You spent time at J. Crew.
Yes.
Well, of course, both mega brands now, especially J. Crew.
Right.
When did this idea for the kind of emporium, well, not emporium, but this club, this menswear club, come to you?
Well, I started when I first, funny enough, my grandparents were dry goods merchants. So they sold everything from bras to plows in a store in Pelahatchie, Mississippi. But funny enough, when I got my driver's license, one of the goals in getting my driver's license is that I would get to go work in a men's clothing store. So it was kind of like lint in the blood or retail in the blood from an early age. And then I was always in search of things I couldn't find or more importantly, couldn't afford.
Couldn't afford.
Yeah.
So it was, you could find more stuff than you could afford.
That's exactly right. And I can remember I worked at Piggly Wiggly in high school.
Mm-hmm.
And
I worked at Kroger.
It was, you know what, that's a great experience too. So Piggly Wiggly was having a grand opening, and so I got to work all these extra hours. So I made a bunch of money in about 3 weeks, and my sister lived in Boston. So I took that money, and I went on a pilgrimage to Louis of Boston.
Because that was the stuff.
The greatest store.
It was the store.
Oh, it was fantastic. And back then, there were probably 10 really great men's stores in the country. There was Allen Bilzerian, which was in Boston. There was Louis of Boston. There was Paul Stewart. There was a guy out of Kansas City. I can't remember their name. But there were a few people that were really, selling better traditional clothes with fashion. Okay? But the price points were crazy. So I went to the other thing I really found out about in Boston was the Army-Navy store.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a Snyder's Army-Navy store there, which was fantastic. They had these crazy, like, dental smocks. And, you know, taking that back to Mississippi for my, you know, senior year of high school was a little bit like, what are you wearing?
Where have you been? What are you doing?
And it's so funny because I told one girl about my great trip to Boston over the summer.
Yeah.
And then on Friday, she wasn't in school. She was a little... She had a wild hair.
She was a wild. Oh.
And she didn't come back on Monday either. And on Tuesday, she came back to school. And we're like, where have you been? She's like, I've been to Boston.
Wow, you sold it. You sold Boston so well that one of your friends skipped school for 2 days and a whole weekend to go to Boston.
So anyway, that's a long-winded way of
saying. She probably didn't go to the Army-Navy store, though.
She did not.
No,
but that was a long-winded way of saying those were the beginnings of wanting a men's store. And then the other thing is designing clothes. I wanted to get into design when I went to New York, but I couldn't get into a design program anywhere. They said, oh, you best get to start over for school. And I got hired by a guy named Robert Lighton who started this company called British Khaki. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I remember British Khaki. Are they still around?
As a furniture company.
Furniture company.
The guy had fantastic taste. And also, he was very nice to me. I mean, he's really said, okay, well, Sid, you're going to sell for me, but here's how you pitch colors. Here's what the warp and weft of a fabric is. Here's how you analyze fabrics. Here's how you fit product. And this is how you price it. And it was like, wow. And I was getting paid to do that. Not much.
Paid to learn.
Paid to learn. I was really getting paid to sell, but I would get in there early and stay late. And not long after that, I got the my then girlfriend's friend went to work for J. Crew over in New Jersey, which was kiss of death for a designer.
Oh, yeah.
Catalog and in New Jersey.
Yep,
nobody wants to do
you're
that.
Done.
You're done. Your career's over.
Yeah, your career's over.
And I was like, fantastic. Somebody's going to give me a shot. And I went there, and you remember the barn jacket?
Sure.
That was one of the first times I did. So they let the leash out, and we went from there. And what was great is there was no logo. The prices were great. It was a fun, fun time to be working for J. Crew. And it kind of set the stage for a little bit of the way they look today. It was kind of preppy, hippie. It wasn't too Grateful Dead, nor was it too prepped.
Is that 10? I guess the Grateful Dead is that's the 10 on the hippie scale, right? I mean, is that as far?
It kind of was.
Yeah.
And it wasn't. It was still a little bit.
But what year are we talking?
We're talking 84, 85, 85.
So prep was still in its secondary reincarnation, pretty strong.
I'm sure at Athens you saw both of those, that whole spectrum.
Oh, sure. Sure. There was the whole indie rock thing on one end, the precursor to grunge.
Yes.
Grunge. And then you had absolutely Perry Topsiders and striped button downs.
Creased khakis.
Creased.
I mean, when I was at Ole Miss, I mean, shoot, we starched our jeans with a crease.
Yeah, but that's Ole Miss. You guys are freaks. I mean, you know, that's Faulkner territory. You're doing things different there.
You're kind of right.
But there's something really important about that, though, because Southern style. My hesitancy to even put those words together, because I know it's done too often. Southern men don't do things like other people do.
Yes.
And I've come to really like that. Mm-hmm. I ran from that for a long time.
Yeah.
Because I went away to other cities. And now as I get older, I'm like, I'm Southern. I'm a Southern man.
Right.
And I like everything that kind of goes with that, because there's an honesty to it. But do you think that a place like, did Ole Miss actually affect you maybe more than you thought it had?
No. I mean, question, because I showed up at Ole Miss wearing some look out of GQ, and all the guys in my pledge class were like, you are a freak. Where are you from? So the other piece I love about that Southern thing is the sort of innate responsibility to hospitality. And so we think about our brand. We're like, we don't want to get too pegged in. But in the end, we want people to come away thinking, gosh, those people really took care of us.
Mm-hmm.
So really, what's the tip of our spear is service. Now, if we don't have the innovation and the sort of fashion-mindedness, we need to go home today. Just give up. You know, because we're always wanting, and you want newness. I mean, you're always looking for, you know, newness. You still want a baseline to go back to. But what's the sort of twist on it? You know, it's like your bow ties that you're doing. You haven't found those.
Or your tie dyed pocket square that I have here in my pocket. I can love the fact that you took something as formal as a linen pocket square, what I see as kind of formal, and did have tie dye on it, which I think is awesome.
Well,
that's willingness to play and to be irreverent.
Well, and it's the same thing with your bow ties. The reason you're making those bow ties with Hook and Albert's because you didn't see those bow ties from anybody else, right?
No. I wanted them.
Yeah, exactly.
I wanted to get what I wanted to get. Now, American men of certainly the last decade, last 20 years, have been adrift, stylistically adrift.
Right.
Whereas I can go to London, I can go certainly to Milan, I can go to a lot of places and immediately soak up a style vibe that's not based on a trend.
Yeah.
It's based on guys knowing who they are and representing it in a manifesting it in the way that they're dressed.
Right.
Why do we suck at that so bad? What's wrong with American men? I mean, let's face it, most American men dress like because their wives buy them clothes or something. I mean, we don't dress very well. And when we do dress, we don't look like we belong in it. Did Casual Friday do us in? Where was the point where we were? Is there a point? Because I look back. Okay. I know that now we look back at a lot of fashion icons from the 50s and 60s. I know you must be getting tired of that. If one more guy walks in and says, I want to dress like Steve McQueen, you probably want to put a bullet in him. But there's a plainness to that. You can't look at it and say, oh, that was this year.
Sure.
But there must have been some place, you know, between the 50s and the mods of London up through Sergeant Pepper and Carnaby Street and all that. Where did we all of a sudden fall off the horse?
Yeah, you know what's funny is growing up, my parents loved the Lawrence Welk show.
My parents did too. We're almost the same age, so yeah. That makes some sense.
And you know, when you watch it, now it's pretty doggone entertaining. I mean, yeah. He was so elegant.
He was very cool,
so smooth, and he's a big guy.
Yeah, he was
a big guy. A very tall guy. But anyway, if you look back at the clothes, because my children at one point were, and I have a bunch of girls, they would love to watch it when they were little because, you know, you had women in these sherbet gowns, you know, and
looking like wedding cakes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Fantastic. And their hair was all coiffed out. And it was just fascinating. And, you know, a guy sort of kind of dancing around with an accordion. What was that guy's name?
I cannot remember the accordion's name.
He was cool,
I can't remember him. He was very suave.
Yeah, but the men wore crazy stuff, like crazy pattern jackets, high vents on their jackets.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I think that late 60s, the switch got flipped. It's like,
did Vietnam do it? What do you think did it?
I think it was just a little bit of that era of things we need to bust out. We've been too tight and we're going to free up. Because listen, a couple of years later, you know, guys at First Baptist Church at Brandon, Mississippi are wearing leisure suits to church.
Yeah.
It's like,
and big old collars.
Big old collars.
Bell bottom flare pants and Kiana shirts.
Yeah.
And
like, what happened? So that must have been sort of 70, 71, 72, somewhere around there. So I think a little bit of the seeds of this, and I'm not a historian, but the seeds of this seem to be changing at that moment. And I look back, and just humor me for a second. If you could name sort of three guys that you love the way they've dressed through the years, who would you name?
The first guy that I ever looked at and said, holy crap. Well, I'll take that back. I mean, I'm of the James Bond generation.
Fantastic. Okay.
Okay. So,
but the early... The Sean Connery James Bond.
Yeah. I mean, when Dr. No, you know, when he's in the casino scene and he's wearing that, as a dinner suit or a supper suit, I guess call it. And he was wearing the jacket with it has the turn up on the cuff, you know, and the Shaw collar. So when I saw him as a kid, when I saw, you know, Sean Connery, because everything went to hell in a handbasket in the Roger Moore years.
Oh, yeah.
Because it was the 70s.
Live and Let Die is still pretty cool.
Live and Let Die is a great movie.
Yeah.
And he wore double breasted in that and pulled it off because he still had a body for it.
And Louisiana helped too.
Louisiana helped. Yes.
Was Jackie Gleason in that too?
No, I can't remember the name. Sheriff.
A country version
Sheriff.
Of Jackie
Gleason.
He was a
country Gleason. Why are you some kind of doomsday machine, boy? And he, of course, he was the man with the golden gun too. I can't remember his name right
now.
Did
he have a cigar?
Chewing on the cigar.
Didn't smoke it.
Oh, secret agent! I love it. It is a very, very good movie. But so, and then... the next guy that I saw that really put the wow on me was Cary Grant.
Yeah, fantastic.
And then Bogart in Casablanca.
Right.
And so I became very enamored of the 40s and 50s style of men's suits.
Got it.
And really kind of got infected with that. But it was at a bad time because I couldn't dress like that through the 70s because there just wasn't.
No.
There wasn't anything.
The
resource for that wasn't there. You know, all of our suits were terrible. And, of course, I didn't have any money.
Yeah.
But then when I got into college, I started buying vintage.
Fantastic.
And that's when you started realizing that these things are out there. You just got to dig for them.
Yeah.
But I would say that those guys are still the ones that I look at now. And you know why? It wasn't because and I realized this recently, and because I think a lot now, ever since you kind of opened my eyes to suits and things like that. In all of those three cases, it was not the clothes.
Yeah.
It was how the men wore them.
Yes.
Cary Grant could walk around wearing a suit. He wears one throughout North by Northwest.
How about the kerchief in To Catch a Thief?
Like, To Catch a Thief.
Really?
Yeah, really. It's done with such absent-minded flair.
Ease.
And ease. You know, Sean Connery in all of the early Bond films.
Leaning up against the Aston Martin.
Leaning up against the Aston Martin. From Goldfinger.
Yeah.
And you realize that it's not really the clothes. It's the ease at which the clothes allow a guy to be.
Yes.
And that is what defines fashion for me. And so I get the thing about, I want to be able to walk down a street in someplace in Mississippi. I want to be able to walk down the street of Milan. I want to be able to eat in a restaurant in New York and still be me in all of those places. But I think that most American men have got no idea who that is.
Well, and the other cool thing that you're touching on, and we started to touch on before we even started this, was there's actual freedom in wearing a suit.
Oh my God.
It's also freedom in having a uniform and there being a dress code, because then guys need directions and they need, you know, we should have a big banner in our store that says, please ask questions, because guys don't want to ask questions when they come in. But the
and
more,
it's not because we don't want to learn.
No, but the more outlined it is, the better off. And I look back to sort of the guys that helped shape my view on that. And I'm totally with you on those three. The only other person I'd add to sort of that era was Cooper. Who's fantastic.
Anderson and Shepard suits, yeah. Again, and exclusively.
Just, and yeah. Then after that, because I had an older brother who's probably 10-ish years older than me. And so the whole sort of I Spy, Get Smart, Robert Culp, Bill Cosby sort of preppy but skinny clothes, mm-hmm. Huge on me. And so I turned to Dick Van Dyke, another example of a guy owning the clothes.
But and always wearing his pants a little on the short side.
A little on the short side.
He always did that.
And what's interesting about that is a lot of people go, oh, you guys want to wear your pants short because you think it's cool. It's like, it's actually a rationale. If you go back to the Duke of Windsor, it makes you
longer
look taller.
Leg.
That's
longer
exactly
leg.
Right. And the Duke of Windsor, who was, I don't know, he might have been 5'4".
Another guy with great fashion sense.
Oh, maybe the best.
Maybe the best
maybe
of all
the best.
Time.
Yeah. But he had no break in his trousers.
No.
And so, but Dick Van Dyke. And then the other one that was super cool was Patrick McGoohan in The Prisoner.
The Prisoner. Who I would say almost lines up in certain aspects with Steve McQueen.
Yes.
In a certain, I don't even know quite
not
how to
as
describe
sexy.
That. No.
Yeah.
No seething sexual energy.
No.
The broodingness.
Oh, and what's
there.
Interesting is, you know, he turned down the Bond role.
Yes,
because
did.
Of the philandering nature
right.
of the Bond character.
Yeah.
So he kind of would push away from that sort of, I'm a sex symbol.
Right.
But I mean, golly, McQueen. It is a cliche, but dadgum, the Great Escape and the cutoff sweatshirt, Bullet and the turtleneck, the Playboy shoes.
Yeah.
I mean, he really, and Thomas Crown Affair, of course. But anyway, back then.
Which I still don't think he looked at home in.
You don't think so?
I don't. I know that he went to a lot of trouble to get that role to prove that he could look good in those clothes. You know, because remember the waistcoats?
Yeah.
The vests were straight across. I don't think he quite ever really pulled it off.
I
saw it recently.
You know what? I think that's a good point. Because I think there are better examples of that look from that time period than him.
Than him. But yeah. He tried real hard, and it's a great movie.
Yeah.
But that's as much about Faye Dunaway as it
Paul
is.
Paul Newman wasn't bad either.
Which is funny, you never remember, I don't remember looking at Paul Newman and thinking, I want to dress like that. I love the way he wears his clothes. Although there's something about wearing a fedora with an undershirt and a sting, which I still like. But so many of his roles, you know, it's like Cool Hand Luke and things
well,
like
cool
that.
Cool Hand Luke looks like what's going on in
yeah,
men's wear now.
Like his chambray work shirts,
yeah,
you know,
exactly.
and stuff like that. But go on.
I think that that's probably where we got a little bit off the merry-go-round of having some looks that sort of were consistently represented. And I think that, you know, what we're trying to say now is, you know what, you wear the right clothes for the right occasion. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to a funeral or a wedding or someplace where you're not sure, overdress. Okay. Just go ahead and do that.
Always overdress a little bit.
I'm with you. But if you're also a guy like me that wears a tie six, 7 days a week, when you go to somebody's backyard party and you're still dressed from work, maybe take your tie off.
Sure, you know? Because you're just going to make other people uncomfortable.
Exactly.
That's not about you.
No.
It's about them.
And in the end, is that's kind of, I guess, what I'm getting at is we really should always be dressing for others. Not to prove something or to really, we're always trying to make people feel good around us. You know, that's what we're doing is trying to lift boats. And the more we can do that, the more accessible we are, the more comfortable everybody's going to be. And then open up. And in a sense, I feel like America could really sort of own a style direction because there is something to us wanting to be comfortable in our clothes and wanting to look, you know, it's like for us, we like the natural shoulder.
Yeah.
We like no pleats. We like things to look easy.
Pleats make guys look fat. I'm sorry.
They do.
And yet, guys that are heavy will go to pleats, and I'm like, that's the last thing that you should be wearing is pleats.
Exactly. It's funny because I can remember back when I was with Land's End, there, I think the group is called SHROOM, maybe the Society for Human Resource Managers, for any of you out there who might know about
Holy
that.
Holy smokes, can, I don't know anything about
SHROOM.
That.
Anyway,
SHROOM.
I addressed them in Las Vegas about what do they do about workforce attire.
Mm-hmm.
And basically it was, you know, if the secretary's you know, wearing the tube top, the cow is out of the barn. You know, it's hard to come back from that. And, you know, if the guy's wearing the Cuervo Gold t-shirt on Friday with his K khakis, you got problems. So it's like, how do you set up these sort of, I hate to call them rules, but they're rules. What's the dress code? And the more you set up those sort of rules and expectations for people, the easier it is for everybody. And then there's not this, you know, sort of confusion about what am I going to wear? And in a funny sense, what you're talking about being so difficult was the, you call it casual Friday or dress down or casualization of the workforce.
The casualization of the workforce.
Yeah. It actually paralyzed people because when a guy had to wear a suit, he knew all he had to pick out was a shirt and a tie. And that was usually white and blue and maybe a dot and a stripe. So he didn't have to occupy his mind. His mind could be focused on taking care of his family and going to work, not on, golly, what am I going to wear today? And I got 20 golf shirts and, you know, I don't know. You know, I've got these khaki pants and where am I going? I mean, it really.
Who am I?
Who am I?
Yeah.
And so I think that it really, and same thing for women. I mean, because in general, people think, oh, women know much more about dressing than men do. And there's some truth to that, but they were just as confused.
They were just as confused. Well, women were going through the entire rewriting of where they even should be.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I mean, when you're at home and you're a homemaker, dressing is actually not terribly complex. You know, you're not messing around with roles. But then when all of a sudden you're playing the same game as men, everything changes.
You know what? You're absolutely right.
Now, are you one of the guys that think that fit above all? Fit number one.
Well, if somebody called me up today and said, hey, Sid, what's the trend for next year? I'd say clothes that fit. And if they call me up next year and say, hey, what's the trend for next year? I'd say clothes that fit. So I think fit is most important.
And there's another place where American men have fallen short. I mean, not every man in Italy is built like a model.
No.
But they like their clothes to fit.
That's right. And sometimes too small.
Well, yeah, yeah. Like in Naples, you see the Neapolitan tug at the jacket where the buttons, like, a lot of my jackets fit
pasta.
Like that, by the way, now. It's a lot of pasta. Yeah. And, you know, in Italy, you know, the carbs, you get a jacket that lasts for 20 years. The problem is your carb intake goes up, you know, and so they just quit buttoning their jackets. But here in America, we just make the clothes too big.
Yeah.
We make them hugely too big, and then we kind of flap around inside of them.
Well, you know, on paper, doesn't bigger sound more comfortable?
No.
Well, I mean, just
it doesn't just, well, because that just means extra fabric in all the wrong places.
Well, this is the thing is a lot of guys think bigger is more comfortable. And the thing about it is if you look at, you know, military uniforms, were they oversized?
No.
In the heck, no.
They fit.
They fit closely. And interestingly, a paradox is the armhole. Okay. A higher armhole that fits closer to the body
allows better movement.
Sounds less comfortable, but actually provides you better movement, and you can move easier. Now they're poorly cut high armholes that are closer to the body, but a well cut armhole that's like that, or a well cut suit that's close to the body is gonna be more comfortable.
Do you find that guys that come into your store for the first time that you have to kind of take them on as a project to educate them?
Some today, and it's interesting because a lot of people are a lot more people today are pretty well read on clothes, but it's a little bit like, you know, learning how to play baseball by reading a book. But you really have to practice and play with it. Guys need to really spend time not just reading about it, but going and really asking questions in a store environment.
One thing that I've certainly learned about, you know, fabric is that, you know, good fabric, I can wear a suit on a plane for 10 hours, get off, shake a couple times, and by the time I hit baggage claim, I look just as good as when I got on the plane.
That's exactly right.
Because the wrinkles fall out.
Yep.
And everything is as it should be. And I don't know if that's Italian fabric more or English fabric more. I know that you guys are sometimes big on Scottish.
Probably English.
Well, it's true. English make better fabric. It's just that the Italians are maybe a little bit better at tailoring it. I don't know.
Well,
depending on your
body.
You
are 150% right. And try not to dry clean it. That's nothing against the dry cleaners out there. It's just that the pounds per square inch that they put on it is tough.
It's very, very difficult.
On a jacket. So light press is what you ask for when you go to a cleaners.
Well, you taught me Suprush.
Oh, yeah.
Suprush.
Fantastic.
Every time I wear a suit or jacket, I brush it before I put it on and when I hang it up.
It kind of lifts some life back into it.
Yep.
Same thing with your shoes, with your
With the shoe trees.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm fanatical about shoe trees. And you taught me that too, which is that if you buy decent shoes and you want them to last, you better put a shoe tree in there because it's basically a big old sponge, big old floppy sponge when you take it off, and it's right. got to dry back in the right shape. And most guys don't know that.
What we're trying to put into our garments that we're making, you know, because we looked all around the world to have our own suits made. We looked in England. We looked in America. We went to a bunch of different makers here. We looked in Canada. We looked in China.
And you would have to.
You do. And then we looked in Italy, and it was clear that the best and the people with the most heart, the highest heart investment was clearly Italy.
Is it fun snorting out those kind of folks and finding, well, you sourcing
know,
that?
You know Dow, our tailor.
Dow, your tailor's outstanding.
He's Mr. from Laos.
From Laos. And he's a miracle worker.
What's amazing is that he... When he goes into a factory, he barely speaks English.
Yeah, his English is tarnished.
Questionable.
Yeah, it's questionable.
And so, and the Italians don't speak any English, yet they speak the same language. It is uncanny that they are on the same page. And he'll say something and show something, and they'll shake their head, no, 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 no. And then by the end, it's the head's going more north and south rather than east and west. And you see that there's this common, and I'm sure it's that way in the kitchen, I would guess.
Well, yeah, because the language of the kitchen is spoken in pans and on fire.
That's exactly
right. It's not spoken with words.
Yeah, and spoken, in this case, with needle and thread and shapes.
Right.
And what's cool is Dow can go in and look at a guy and cut a pattern right there. But I take him to Italy, so it's he and me and a translator. And that's it. Because the people in the factory, they're not, it's not like you're going to Milan or Florence where, you know, English is sort of the lingua.
Right. It's the business language.
Exactly. Here it's, you know, there might be one person in the factory that speaks English. So it is a lot of fun. I mean, you would love it.
Oh.
Because it's a constant state of learning. And
there is a lot to know.
And one of the factories that we're working in right now is we were... we'd work on the floor, and then we'd go into this back room and do some business conversations. And so the guy says, would you like some lunch? We said, yeah, we're hungry.
Yeah.
And so sure enough, 10 minutes later, this lady just shows up with plates of pasta and a big bowl of soup and some salad and just puts it right on the table where we're working. And then the lady walks out, and I was like, Rosario, who's that lady? He said, oh, that was my mother. And so this family environment, and that's interesting also, the food piece, how attached it is to the clothing piece. Because this place that I'm talking about, where there's only 25, 30 people working, they're serving lunch. First people to eat are the people on the sewing line. So
management eats last.
Management is last.
Well, in Italy, the hierarchy of generations is something that holds everything together in society. I remember when I went to school for a semester in Italy, and I would go eat at someone's house, and I was always kind of shocked. Wow, there's at least three generations in this house.
Right.
You know, in America, we get rid of each other as soon as we can. we can't work things out. We go our separate ways. But
yeah.
In Italy, there's this constant transferal of knowledge, constant generational flow because they're under one roof.
Yeah, you're right. Well, it's interesting that you say that too, because our oldest daughter graduated from college last year, and she moved back in with us. And so I said to Dow from Lao, who's got six kids, and I said, Dow, what do you do about your kids moving back in? Because as Westerners,
we're not.
When you finish college,
out you go.
See ya.
I'm done with you for.
Yes. And he said, well, you open the door. You let them back in. I said, really? He's like, yeah. And I said, okay, well, how about if they get married? He said, well, if sometimes they move out and sometimes they move in. He says, that's the way we live. And I said, as Westerners, it's a very unusual, I say Westerners, people from the United States.
Yeah.
That's not really the way we work.
Well, no, we would take that as a failure, in fact.
You're
can't stand up on your own two feet.
Yeah.
And so you've come home because you can't take care of yourself.
That family unit there is what drives it.
Well, you and I have often talked about how we wish we had a men's club. We want a club.
When are we going to start that?
I am. You know, I have this this book. I think maybe we talked about this, called The Gentlemen's Clubs of London.
Which is so, let me tell you something.
we should make that the that you have to own one of those before we tell you that it's important to own one.
Yes.
To be in this club.
Yes.
I have that book.
It's a fantastic
book.
Okay, so
on Friday night.
I had some other friends with that book.
On Friday night, I went to a guy's house in Atlanta to eat pizza. And I walk in and I look, he's got the Gentleman's Club of London book right
sitting
there
on his coffee table. Like,
it's not a popular book.
No, it's not even print. I mean, they're not hard. They're not easy to find.
Yeah. But I think that might be. So for those of you, go out and get that book.
Gentlemen's Clubs. It's not like Gentlemen's Club, like places with, you know, bars that have dancers on them. This is real Gentlemen's Clubs. And and I don't know why I want that so badly. I mean, in this day and age, but for some reason, I just really would like to be a member of that kind of club.
You've probably heard of this term before. It's the third place. Have you heard of that?
No.
I think I'm going to sound stupid because I'm going to botch it a little bit, but I think it's like a sociological term that refers to the places you inhabit your life. So the first is home, then work, and what's your third place? Okay, is it the 19th hole at the golf club, or is it your softball team, or is it your Sunday school class, or what's your third place?
I think one of the reasons that I started flying airplanes was to have a third place. You know, the flight school community and the cockpit community is a third place.
It's like the guy is buying his first suit.
Yes.
And he's walking up to the suit for the first time. What does he need to look at?
What are some things that you can tell them that they can walk up and touch it and look at it and know that they're looking at a real garment that it could be with them for a while?
Okay, well, this is the thing is first of all, I don't want to presume that everyone can spend the kind of money that we're charging for this product, okay?
Well, let's assume that a guy at some point in his life is going to come to a position where spending $1,000 on a suit is not at all out of the question. Now, you and I know that in the world of menswear, if you can find a good suit for $1,000, that's a bargain.
It is. And again, I know there's a lot of people who go, man, I never paid more than $295 for a suit, which I understand that too.
But you will.
So the main point of a men's jacket was that it was full canvas.
Okay, so full canvas. Now, I don't see any canvas here. So what are you talking about?
So that's saying that the exoskeleton, okay, which is the part you can't see
in between the lining and the outside
exterior fabric. There inside there is a piece of wool and camel hair woven together canvas, which looks like just a piece of canvas.
Is it almost like a vest on the inside?
That's exactly what it is. And what it is it's been shaped and it's been stitched in a way that it's going to provide all the structure for you to wear this. And a full canvas means that the whole front of the jacket is all canvas. And there's really three levels of suit making. There's what's called engineered / fused / glued. Okay, so engineered is the best. Glued is almost pejorative. But it's the same thing. And what they do is they put a laminate on a lining to put inside the jacket so it can run through the factory quicker and does not need as highly skilled of an operator to make the suit.
So can you walk up and actually feel which one of those you're getting?
Yes. So
because they'll separate.
You'll see.
All right, I'm feeling.
Feel right there.
I'm trying to pull the outside of the jacket away. Okay, I can pull it away.
That's
I can feel
exactly
the canvas.
Right.
I can feel, pull
well,
it away.
You can feel fabric to fabric.
Fabric to fabric.
So you know that there's a free-floating piece inside
It's not
there.
Fused.
Exactly. Now, the second level is called semi-tailored, semi-traditional, or half canvas.
Okay.
Okay. And what that is that the chest piece is canvas, but the rest of the front of the jacket is fused. Again, so they can run it through.
So how do you feel that difference?
Well, when you touch it on the inside
of the bottom here. I'm down near the bottom hem now.
When you try to pull that apart,
it won't.
There will be a laminate, and you can feel almost a rubbery, or there's another layer in there that you can feel.
On this suit, I'm way down past the bottom, the side pocket, down near the bottom of the jacket, and I can still feel two pieces of fabric there, so I know that this is full canvas.
Exactly. And see, what that does, and then the third level is a... In Italy, they call it traditional.
Yes.
And that traditional means that it's full canvas. And what that canvas does is it's like a good pair of jeans. It will break and mold to your body. A semi-traditional or something with laminate or a fused jacket will never really break down to your body. It's always
because it can't move. You will always be wearing it instead of it becoming part of your body.
It will always be wearing you.
Okay. It will always be wearing you.
Yes. So you're the malleable part. It won't move. It will not ever really develop the personality that a full canvas piece.
Well, I think most people realize that you buy a suit, the right suit can actually mold itself to you, is what you're saying.
That's exactly right.
So this full, this canvas interior of this suit is the thing that will eventually make that suit yours.
Right.
So now we're looking at the inside of the jacket, at where the, what do you call the fabric that goes down the arm?
Just the sleeve lining.
The sleeve lining, where the sleeve lining meets the actual jacket lining. And in the case of this jacket, they're two different colors.
That's right. And this is what's inside the sleeve lining is a little bit lighter.
Than what's in the body.
Yeah, but it needs to be some sort of satiny.
So your arm can slide.
Exactly, because you find jackets that don't have a lining that's easy to move in and out of. It is so frustrating.
Sure.
Because
taking it off is terrible, too.
The worst.
Now, if I'm buying a jacket, I'm buying a suit, I've established, it's full canvas.
Yes.
I should not automatically assume that the stitching between the arm and the...
You can go ahead and...
You can assume that? That those are going to be hand-stitched?
Yeah, if they're going to the trouble of making it full canvas, some of the other...
That's going to be there.
That should be there, okay?
So all I got to look for is the full canvas. I'm done.
Pretty much. Now, the other thing is sometimes you see a fabric that's so beautiful and a price is so great, and you go, it's only half canvas, but it just looks great. Okay, buy it. But
just know, it's not ever going to be...
It won't. And you know what, Lee? I've had jackets before that I've gotten pretty good wear out of, but something always is like, dadgummit, that jacket doesn't break down naturally. Then the other piece that's very important to put on by hand is the neck. Okay, and so what the reason these two points are important is because the neck needs to wrap around your neck very well. The worst is when you see a jacket
and
it's sitting back...
Or it's got that big puff and pucker in the back.
Yeah, and that's usually because you have very square shoulders.
Okay.
So the collar needs to be shortened.
Okay.
So that's usually because you've got a physical difference.
Okay.
And it usually, like, remember Pete Samuelson?
Yeah, sure.
His shoulders were like a board.
Big, yeah.
You know, so he always had to have that pinched out. But anyway, the other thing, because that's a very sensitive part, and then the armhole is, and so it requires...
Finesse.
It requires the understanding of the tension that I need to put into the jacket, as opposed to just
running through the sewing machine. So if I'm a guy and I walk into a menswear store and I take the jacket, and there's someone's watching me that works at the store, and that salesperson or helper sees me feeling the fabric down there at the bottom of the jacket, and then he sees me flip up the collar and look at the needlework around the back. He's going to say,
"Who do you work for?"
But he's going to know. That tells him, I know that I'm looking for some things here, and I know what quality looks like. Is that something you'd like to see in a customer?
Well, yes. We do.
You do, certainly.
But the other thing to look for us is we only use three types of buttons on our jacket. We use what the Italians call corno, which is horn.
Horn, right.
Genuine horn, which is shed from a...
Buffalo horn, probably right? Water buffalo.
Yeah, probably from India. And they bring it to Italy, cut it, and polish it. And then we also use corozo, which is a nut from Brazil. The tagua nut.
The tagua nut.
And that was used as actually an ivory substitute, I think back in the 40s. What's so beautiful about it is when you see a tagua nut or a corozo nut sliced, it looks just like ivory. And it's got these beautiful veins in it. And so when you dye it the color, whether it's red, orange, blue, black, brown, you still can see it's almost like a burled wood. You can see a little bit.
Well, it's got a little tiger eye almost to it, doesn't it? The striations.
That's exactly right. So it's beautiful. And then the last we use is a pearl, usually a trochus, but also a mother of pearl. On the jackets. So,
which is best?
Well, some guys would say mother pearl. I like trochus better because it doesn't cast as much color. The mother pearl in its sort of naturalish state casts a little pink.
A lot of pink.
And again, this is at this point we're
not arguing.
We're arguing over nothing.
Yeah.
You know, but it is, I like the trochus better because it's a little less opinionated than the mother pearl. The mother pearl's a little more luxurious though.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, what's cool about all these is they're green. Okay. The horn keeps resupplying itself.
Yeah. It fell off.
Okay.
The nuts you regrow.
Regrow. And the
mother of pearl is
and you can
naturally harvested.
The other points that are great are handmade buttonholes. Again, not a deal breaker.
Buttons put on by hand. That's beautiful, too. That's the Navy.
That's beautiful. I like both of those suits. Yeah. Great deal.
Let's see. The other... we like also... This we love is almost no shoulder pad.
Okay? I don't like shoulder pads. But I just don't care for it.
Most guys don't need them. And nope. We find that for guys that do need them, we can always, in our tailoring shop, we can add a little pad to the jacket if necessary. But most of the time... The shoulder pads become almost like false advertising.
Yeah.
It's like stuff.
That's not you. That's not you. As soon as you take the jacket off, it's like, whoa.
What happened to you?
What the heck?
Yeah.
That's like a Batman suit with built-in abs.
That's exactly right.
Sid, thanks for being with us. So this is the part of the show, the podcast, as it were, that we usually dive into some culinary issue, and we will. But we've been talking with a clothes guy, and a guy that has had a really large effect on the kind of clothes that I wear and my style, and I like to think that I've got some of that. And oddly enough, I get a lot of questions, especially via Twitter, some by Facebook, but mostly via Twitter, about fashion. And I've put these, not fashion, style's big difference. Fashion comes and goes. Style, you make your own. You can't own fashion. You can't have your own fashion. You can't have your own style. Anyway, I get a considerable amount of questions on satirical issues via Twitter. So, and I've been kind of like sticking them all in a file thinking, well, I'll get to those one day. And I figure, well, maybe now's the time. I mean, we've been talking to Sid Mashburn, who's a cool guy. So why not dive in on a few of these? And I, maybe you'll get something out of them. You never know. It's not food, but there is more to life than food. I know that shocks some of you, but... That's true. All right. So Sam Twittered me asking about the single most important item in a man's wardrobe. This is a big question because, one could easily say underwear, but that's not, something you actually have to have. Pants, I'm assuming pants, at least in this culture. So Sam, I'm going to say that the most single important item in a man's wardrobe, especially if you're just starting out and kind of setting up your wardrobe. And this is an old answer, and I bet that 90% of you know what I'm going to say. It's the navy blazer. Abso-stinking-lutely, the navy blazer. But here's the thing. You got to put some attention into the navy blazer. I mean, the navy blazer has got a long history. It is military in origin. I hear that, what I've read has told me that the captain of a ship in Victorian England, captain of the Her Majesty's ship, the Blazer, oddly enough, although I'm not sure I believe that part, decided that when he knew his crew was going to be reviewed by Queen Victoria and had double-breasted jackets made for all the men out of this dark blue fabric, and that was the birth of the navy blazer. I don't know that I believe that, but it's definitely of military origin. All of our records point to military-style jackets being where actually most of menswear comes from, quite frankly, except for the bell-bottom jeans. Well, no, what am I saying? That comes from the Navy. That's right. It comes from the United States Navy. Gosh, so actually everything except, well, I'll think of something. But so the Navy blazer, here's the thing about the Navy blazer. There is no place you can't go wearing one, okay? I can fly my plane and get off the plane in summer looking sweaty and wrinkled and ruffled, and I can put on my blue blazer and anybody will let me in anywhere. They will. They will. If you have the right blue blazer, you can walk in any place with it. It transforms you. But here's the thing. You need to spend some money on your blazers. Now, we all have, different styles that we adhere to. The American cut of the blue blazer, navy blazer, tends to be two-button. Often only has a single vent. I tend more toward the European, especially the Italian variety, which typically has three buttons in the front, a lapel that rolls back rather than folds, and double vents. I'm going to tell you about my navy blazer. Actually, I have two. I have a winter blazer. Navy blazer that has patch pockets and elbow patches to make me look even smarter, a lot smarter than I actually am. And I have a blazer that I wear the rest of the time. What we're talking about here is you're really spending the money for wool, good tropical weight wool or cashmere if you're really rolling in dough. And you're paying for cut, but you want to buy this at a place where they're going to be able to tailor it for you. And you're going to want it to have enough room to move in, but you don't want it to be too big. The worst thing, the worst mistake American guys make with their jackets, they don't get them to fit right, okay? You don't want a bunch of padding in the shoulder. You want a soft fit in the shoulder. You want it to be comfortable. This should be the kind of jacket you could wear doing almost anything, and you should be able to wear it with anything, okay? And again, this is not a jacket your wife picks out, okay? Stop letting your wife buy your clothes, okay? So you're going to buy your own clothes, and you're going to buy yourself a blazer. And if you don't have enough money, you're going to save up, or you're going to buy one secondhand. Right? I don't care what you do, but you're going to buy a good tropical weight blue blazer. It is going to fit you. You're going to have it fitted for you. Look, if you're loaded, have it made custom for you. I'm not made out of that kind of cash. I'm a mere cable celebrity. So here's what I did. I was in... I bought mine in Seattle. My good blazer I bought in Seattle at a men's store called Mario's, and it was made by Brunello Cucinelli, and it was their travel blazer. It's unlined, but it's got a bunch of pockets on the inside. It has kind of a high peak collar, so it's kind of got an extra classy, let me in at the Ritz kind of look to it. And it's lightweight. It has flat pockets and a ticket pocket. That's a small pocket above the main pocket over on the right that you can stick stuff in. And I'm always sticking stuff like an eyeglasses cloth or a guitar pick or, you know, silver dollar or something over there, something I want to get to pretty quickly. So you're going to have this jacket, and you know what? You're going to change the buttons on this jacket seasonally, all right? Listen to me on this. The buttons, these small details, are really what set men's fashion aside, all right? Now, I've got three sets of buttons for my blazer, all right? Now, this Cucinelli blazer came with kind of these silver, actually, they might even be tin, I don't know, but they're silverish buttons, and they're pretty nice, so I keep them. For winter, and when I want to really look classy, I got a nice set of antique brass buttons. Some people go with gold-plated. I think that's rather pimpish, but that's okay if that's how you want to roll. I've also got some dark, actually, that's right, I got four sets. Dark mother of pearl buttons that I bought online. They were vintage and I bought them, and I'll have those traded out. And then I've got a set of white buttons. Now, my white buttons are really interesting because I found them when I was making Feasting on Asphalt, the motorcycle documentary I made for Food Network. We were in this town on the Mississippi where they used to make buttons out of freshwater clamshells. And I found some of these buttons actually in the mud along the river, and I bought some also at a secondhand store. So they're all made in this town. And the cool thing is none of them match. They don't match exactly. But I have them for both the front of the jacket and the sleeves. Now, on the sleeves, I go four button, and I make sure that I have real buttonholes. One of the things I always look at on a men's jacket, if I meet a guy, I look to see if his jacket on a suit or his blazer, if those are real buttonholes on the sleeve. Because you know what? If they're just sewn on, they're just sewn on. That's an affectation. So here's the thing you do is you get your tailor, you find a tailor, you make them put real buttonholes there, and you always leave, at least I always leave, the bottom button undone. So that I got a little more room right at the wrist, and it also says, hey, my buttonholes are real. Okay, so there you go. So trade out your buttons seasonally. Typically, guys will go with the metal buttons in fall and winter, and the mother of pearl or some other kind of shell button in the summer. You will not have plastic buttons. Do you hear me? You will not have, say it with me, I will not have plastic buttons on my blazer. Thank you very much. Here's the other thing you're going to do. You're going to buy yourself a suit brush. All right. This is a big brush. Mine came from a company called Kent. It's an English company that makes really good suit brushes. You're going to hang your jacket every time you wear it. When you take it off at the end of the day, you're going to brush it. That's going to get all the nasty little pieces of food and bits of junk off of it that can make it fall apart before it's time. Then before you put it on every time, you're going to brush it again. Now, I know that sounds like a lot of brushing, but it takes about a minute. Okay. Every now and then I steam mine. Okay. About once a month, I steam it. That kills bacteria and stuff like that. What I don't do, unless I absolutely have to, is dry clean it. Dry cleaning solvent is powerful stuff. And every time you dry clean a good suit or blazer, you're basically shaving about a year, maybe 2 years off the life of that garment. Okay. Steaming and brushing should be enough. If you need to clean it more often because you've done something like, here's a good example. Okay. Here's a guy who always looked fantastic. And this is important. You need to have fashion icons, guys. You need to have guys that you look up to fashion wise. Mine were typically in the past. All right. I grew up, I wanted to look like Humphrey Bogart. Then I started realizing actually Cary Grant's the one who's got it going on. And I remember so strongly the first time I saw North by Northwest. all of North by Northwest, Cary Grant's basically wearing a gray flannel suit with a white shirt. And he's doing all kinds of stuff, guys. He's all over the place. He's running from crop dusters, all right? He's climbing around on Mount Rushmore, and he's looking great while he's doing it, okay? All right, so anyway, the point is, I remember very well that when he's been hit by the crop duster, and he's got crap all over the suit, and he calls the valet at the hotel and asks for a sponge and press. These are words that need to be revised, because what you do is you sponge clean. You clean the suit with a damn sponge, and then you press it. That's all that most suits ever need, and that is most certainly all that your navy blazer is going to need. Have I said everything I want to say about navy blazers? No. The navy blazer needs to be part of you. It is something that you've got to feel very comfortable wearing, and you should be able to wear it with everything. If you can't wear it with jeans, with khakis, with cords, with gray flannels, then you probably shouldn't buy the gosh darn thing. But above all, what's the main lesson? You're not going to let your wife buy it. Oh, and do not buy it in a shop that sells golf clubs. If you do, I will hunt you down. I swear I will. All right, next question. This comes in from a lady. Alyssa asks about the one pair of shoes I can't live without. And it's interesting, guys, because girls notice shoes. They do. They pay attention to them. Alyssa, I got to say, the one pair of shoes I don't think I could live without, I've got this pair of suede chukkas. That's kind of like a desert boot. You know, it comes up on the ankle, usually only has holes for four lace positions, but it's a hard leather heel shoe, and it's in suede. It's brown, a little bit beat up, but I couldn't live without those shoes. They cover me in 90% of all possible avenues, and so I would definitely go with those chukkas. It's important to have, you know, at least a few different kinds of shoes, but yeah, those are the ones I couldn't live without. Good question though. Next question comes in from Larry, and Larry asked me via Twitter: is it more important to play by the style rules or to break them? It's a fantastic question. And my answer to you, Larry, would be, you know what? It's great to break the rules, but here's the thing. Listen closely. When you break the rules, you have to do it in such a way so that it highlights the fact that you know what the rules are to begin with. In other words, you must break them in a way that shows you know them. Okay. Otherwise, you just don't know them. And that says something, and that's bad. So you've got to carefully break the rules. But before you even do that, I would say, look to your style, spirit animals. Okay. Every man needs to have other guys that he looks towards and says, yeah, you did it right. Even if I'm not going to dress like you, the way you wore your clothes, the way you looked, I dig it. Now mine are mostly dead. Humphrey Bogart, was my original spirit animal in this style sense. Cary Grant could look great wearing anything, and he dressed very simply. He was definitely a lesser, more kind of guy. I grew up in the 60s and 70s. James Bond, big influence on me, especially Sean Connery. So these are guys that mostly dressed by the rules. Steve McQueen broke the rules a little bit, you know. Yeah, you see Bullet, and you know, that's the first time that a guy really wore a turtleneck that way. I mean, it was a big deal. But by and large, you need to figure out who you kind of want to not emulate, but at least use an example. You know, it might be your dad, it might be a grandfather, but it should be somebody that's probably more dapper than you are. I mean, quite frankly, if I could dress any way I wanted, I would probably dress a little bit more towards the Victorian. You know, I love what they did with Robert Downey Jr.'s clothes in the Sherlock Holmes movies. I think that's badass. The way he looked. Wearing a, you can rock an ascot. Who wouldn't rock an ascot? I would so rock an ascot. Anyway, know what the rules are and then decide how to break them, and know when to break them. You know, it's like, you don't break rules when you go to a wedding. Don't break rules when you go to a funeral. Know what the rules are and live with them. You know, down here in the South, on a summer night, if I'm going to a party that I know is going to be outside, you know what? I might wear a seersucker suit, but with a tie worn as a belt, just to say it's a sash. I'm a pirate. Live with it. You know, but I don't care. And see, that's something that you kind of have to realize. How much do you care what other people think? I don't. I dress for me. I don't dress for anybody else. I don't dress for my wife. Don't dress for my kid. I don't want to look like a clown, but you know what? I'll wear a kilt. I will rock a kilt. And you know what? That's kind of the key to breaking rules. You've got to do it in a way that says, I am owning this 100%. I go to New York City in the summertime. Sometimes I see a guy wearing a suit with short pants, a short pant suit. And you know what? If a guy can wear it, and if a guy wears it, actively wears it, owns that suit, you know what? It's cool. But if for one moment, if one moment you see a glint in his eye that says, I'm scared of this, it's over. It's done. Just something to think about. One of the best style questions I've gotten via Twitter came from somebody named Sydney. And I'm sorry, I don't know if it's a boy Sydney or a girl Sydney, but it was simply one word with a question mark. And the word was pleats with a question mark. Okay, here's the answer, Sydney, either boy Sydney or girl Sydney. The answer to the question pleats is no. Pleats never make anybody look better. And as far as I'm concerned, the more pleats you have, the more out of touch with style you are. Heavy guys think that pleats make them look thinner. Are you kidding? You might as well be wearing jodhpurs. I mean, it's a terrible look. Keep your pants clean front. Now, if you go to Anderson and Shepherd, the famous tailor in London, and you buy a suit in maybe a Glen Plaid or a Prince of Wales, and they say, "Sir, we suggest a single pleat," you do what they say, okay? Because they're professionals. But otherwise, you stay away from pleats. Promise me. A guy named Wes texted me and just said, I want to dress snappy. Don't have a lot of money. What do I do? Okay, here's the deal, Wes. Can you dress better if you have a bunch of money? Sure, because you have more options. But there have been some really, really sharp dressed guys out there, and you can look at them through the history of media, and they didn't have a whole lot of money. But what they did was they had an eye for detail. Okay, now you can walk into Goodwill and buy a suit that's 30 years old. If you know your names, let's say that you walk, okay, let's say that you buy a 25-year-old Armani suit. Let's just say for a moment that you do that. Okay, if it even comes close to fitting, then what you need to do is you need to buy that suit, okay? But what you need to do is you need to find a tailor who can make it fit better. Fit is everything. Fit, fit, fit. It's like the location, location, location of real estate. You need your clothes to fit. And then you know what? If you can't afford a lot of fancy stuff, accessorize wisely. All right. I would rather see you buy one great tie, you know, like a Drake's knit tie from Drake's in London, or which you can buy anywhere in America. Or you know what? Go to Netro, you know, which is expensive as all get out. It's an Italian fashion house, and buy a pocket square. They make the most amazing pocket squares you've ever seen in your life, and you can wear them 50 different ways. I'd rather see you buy a thrift store suit, have it tailored to you, and then get yourself a great pocket square, because you know what? That says something. It makes a statement, and it makes a personal statement. Little details are a big, big deal. You know what? Buy yourself a beat up plain vintage watch, but put a nice strap on it. A nice, you know, maybe Italian strap or shell cordovan strap. Get yourself a nice pocket square. Get yourself a decent tie. I'm a really big fan of this company called Hook and Albert that makes these little fabric lapel flowers. You know, make a little statement like that. Go online and go to eBay and find somebody who's selling a 50-year-old alligator belt and buy that alligator belt for $25 that would cost you $500 somewhere else. Get a new buckle for it and rock an alligator belt. That shows you care. It shows you've got an eye. It shows you've got style. All right, food and fashion fans, that is all that we have got for you today on the Alton Browncast. A special thanks to all the callers and people that wrote in with their questions, and of course to Mr. Sid Mashburn, who I can only say if you're a guy and you can get by his store off of Howell Mill Road in Atlanta sometime before you die, it'd be a good idea. His wife, Ann Mashburn, has got a fantastic women's store that adjoins it, and they also sell some pretty awesome stereos, which, I don't know, you know, 20 years ago wouldn't have made any sense, but now it does. Anyway, the Alton Browncast will be back with more fascinating fair in, I don't know, a few days, weeks, whatever it takes us to find another interview. Anyway, until then, America, cook smart.